This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The House of Representatives has been poisoned by partisanship, according to the new book Fight Club Politics. My guest is the author, Juliette Eilprin. Her book examines how Congress has changed since 1994, when Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich, became the majority party in the House for the first time in 40 years. She writes, lawmakers on both sides have become more accountable to the party apparatus and less accountable to the public, and this in turn has encouraged them to become more ideologically entrenched and less inclined to reflect voters' broad interests. Eilprin is a national correspondent for The Washington Post and a former congressional correspondent for the paper. What's some of the evidence you'd offer that the House is more polarized than it's been in recent memory?
The first I would say is that there's a score called the DW Nominate score, which is a political science test which looks at where members of Congress are ideologically. And what that's shown is that Republicans are more conservative than they used to be. In fact, they're roughly 73% more conservative than they were in the 1970s. And Democrats are more liberal, though not to the same extreme. They're roughly 28% more liberal than they used to be. Then you could also look at just what members of Congress tell me about their lives. And I found this quite disturbing and compelling in terms of giving us a sense of what's happening in Washington. They simply don't talk to each other anymore. I talked to an off-the-record group of 20 House Democrats just a week ago, and we discussed how I was discussing restoring civility to Washington. And essentially, the message I got back is, why in the world would you ask us to spend time, even if the cameras aren't on, reporters aren't taking notes, discussing policy with Republicans, because we just don't have any incentive to work with them, and they don't listen to us. Everything from that to the fact that a tennis coach here in Washington told me that while she coaches some of the top politicos in town, and she explained to me that years ago she would create doubles matches and no one would mind what team they're on. And again, several years ago, people started saying, are you going to make me play with a Democrat on my side or a Republican on my side? Because that's just not acceptable. And I think that's really a testament to how polarized things have gotten in Washington.
You trace the hyper divisions in Congress back to 1994 when Newt Gingrich was elected and the Republicans became the majority party in the House for the first time in 40 years. You say the Democrats had certainly taken advantage of their majority for 40 years, but that the Republicans kind of took it to a new level. And you say that Gingrich and Dick Armey of Texas embarked on an unprecedented campaign to convince Americans that they needed to overthrow the established order. What are some of the changes that they said they wanted to make?
They said that they wanted to make Congress more accountable to the public, that they were going to have a more open process on the House floor so that people could express their views. They vowed to bring up a number of bills that they said reflected what the public wanted, including potentially term limits on members of Congress so they couldn't serve as long as they could. And really, they vowed to end corruption that Congress had experienced under House Democratic rules.
So Republicans campaigned on making, you know, the House more fair, more balanced. But once they were established as the majority party, did they change the rules to shut out the minority Democrats?
Absolutely. They have effectively shut out the minority Democrats. I don't think many people would take issue with that. If you look at what amendments they brought up, I mean, it's really kind of stunning. They will have, for example, major pieces of legislation where in some cases they don't allow any Democratic amendments to come up for a vote on the House floor. In some cases, maybe they'll allow them one amendment to come up on the House floor. And that really, in the eyes of many members, violates a basic test of democracy, which is that the House of Representatives, which is theoretically supposed to be closest to the ordinary American public, isn't allowing members of Congress who represent hundreds of thousands of people to express themselves through legislation. And that's really one of the clearest examples we see of where Republicans have not lived up to the promise of revolution.
What is the process or the rule changes that they used to shut out Democrats from making amendments and having direct input into most legislation?
There's a committee called the House Rules Committee, And that is the panel that sets the terms for the debate for any given bill. And this is extremely powerful because essentially what this panel does is they decide who gets amendments on the floor that ultimately are put to a test of the full House. And so if they deny members' amendments, then you never really get a sense of whether the majority of members of Congress support one idea or another. And while he didn't change the makeup of the Rules Committee, to my knowledge, what he did is he, again, installed someone who was very loyal to him. Jerry Solomon was the first chairman. Now it's someone named David Dreyer from California. And he instructed them to essentially rig the rules of debate to benefit Republicans. And so, while they had initially campaigned on making it more open and more fair and giving the minority more input, over time what you've seen is that they've narrowed the terms of debate so that Democrats rarely have a chance to offer amendments on meaningful questions. This was, for example, very obvious during the impeachment debate, where some members of Congress wanted a chance to censure President Clinton rather than impeach him. And the leadership decided that's out of bounds. We're never going to allow for a censure vote because that's going to give moderates a way out of impeaching the president. And so they demanded an up or down vote. And we've seen this on a score of issues, whether it's malpractice reform or Social Security or things like that. They repeatedly say, it's, again, our way or the highway. Either you're voting for the Republican vision, or you're out in the cold.
Can you explain a little bit more the process and the rules changes that have prevented Democrats largely from adding amendments to legislation?
For every bill that comes out for a vote on the House floor, the Rules Committee passes a rule. And the rule sometimes includes changes in the underlying text of the bill, or it just lays out what are the different amendments that can be considered. It'll say, on this bill, we're going to have 6 amendments, or 20 amendments, or 25 amendments. And so the Rules Committee, which is overwhelmingly controlled by Republicans, they have a greater advantage on that committee than any other committee in the House of Representatives, decides who gets to offer what changes to a bill. So the rules that they pass have a huge impact on the substance of the legislation ultimately, because it says how much members are going to have a chance to tinker with the bill. And so they pass a rule which says we're going to allow debate, first of all, for X period of time. One thing they might do is make the debate very short so that members don't have a chance to really speak about the matter of hand, or again, offer up alternatives to what the majority has crafted. And so all of those things have a huge impact on what ultimately the House of Representatives produces in terms of legislation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Juliette Alperin, and her new book is called Fight Club Politics, How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives. Now, you say that Newt Gingrich transformed the relationship between committee chairs and House leaders. What did he do?
What he essentially did is he upended the old system, which existed under the Democrats, of the seniority system for committee chairmen. Under the Democratic practice, if you stuck around for long enough, you eventually would get to chair a committee because it was simply done by the amount of time you had served in the House. Newt Gingrich had a different vision for how he wanted to rule Congress. He made it more of a loyalty test and a fundraising test. He said to Republicans that they could only get to the top of committees if they proved that A, they had a better way of ruling the committee, would be loyal to the leadership, and were effective in helping the Republicans maintain their hold on power. And that made committee chairs much more beholden to the leadership under the Republicans, as opposed to Democrats, where many committee chairs acted as almost free agents, where they would have their own fiefdoms and would have extraordinary control over what happened in those committee rooms.
So what does it mean to have the committee chairs have more party loyalty and to be more beholden to the leaders of the party or to the House Speaker?
It means essentially that committees become the extension of the Republican leadership, and they do what the leaders want. And that can be very significant. You can look at things like there was a massive telecom bill that was done several years ago towards the beginning of Republican rule. And the committee had a strategy and a bill that they were considering. And at the last moment, Newt Gingrich helped rewrite the bill. And that was ultimately the bill that committees passed. And again, this takes power away from rank and file members who traditionally within these committees have been able to shape the vision of legislation that you're having. And instead, it allows the leadership, often working with lobbyists, to have more of an impact on what the final bill is that comes out of any given panel.
And where do the lobbyists come in this process now in terms of helping to write the bill?
Really what's happening is that they're more focused on the leadership and influencing those men and women than, say, your ordinary member on a committee or even the committee chair, because they know that if at the end of the day it's going to be the speaker and his deputies who are going to write the legislation, why waste your time dealing with a committee member when really you can influence the process from the top?
And that would probably mean, too, that the lobbyists are proportionately giving more of their money to the leadership, who then doles it out to who they think will be beholden to the party, as opposed to giving the money to individual congressmen. Is that right?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things I explore in my book. One thing you've seen, which again has really taken hold of Congress in the past decade, is something called leadership political action committees. And what this is it allows the senior men and women in Congress to sweep up the money from K Street, the lobbyist crowd, and then redistribute it to rank and file members. And what this does is it again both gives lobbyists an incredible amount of influence because they're donating this money to leaders, but then it gives leaders the chance to have greater sway over rank and file members because these members of Congress become very dependent on their leaders for campaign contributions. And as Tom Davis, a senior Republican and committee chair from Virginia, put it to me, money talks and big money talks even bigger. And he was referring to the impact that leaders can have once they dole out campaign contributions from these leadership political action committees.
Okay, and how have these tests of loyalty and this new system of fundraising and giving out money, how has that affected what you describe as the growing partisanship in Congress and the more extreme nature of the parties?
What it does is it really cuts down and hampers rank and file members' ability to cross party lines and work collaboratively with members on the other side, because essentially they know they'll be punished on a few different levels. They might be punished in terms of losing key committee slots. For example, recently there were two committee chairmen who lost their posts because they had defied the leadership. Joel Heffley, a conservative Republican from Colorado, had headed up the Ethics Committee when they were considering the case against Tom DeLay, the former majority leader, who was under scrutiny for a number of ethical violations. They ultimately ended up chastising him several times right before the 2004 election. And as a result, he lost his committee chairmanship. And when a couple members of the committee complained about the treatment of Joel Heffley by the leadership, they were booted as well.
And do you think the Democrats are any different from the Republicans in how they use like money and committee chairmanships to control the members?
It's interesting. They're really doing their best to imitate the Republicans at this point. For example, Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader from California, has been making a big effort to intimidate members of her party for crossing party lines. And one of the clearest examples we've seen of this is Ed Towns is a Democrat from New York who voted in favor of a Central American Free Trade Agreement, which Pelosi and the rest of the Democratic leadership opposed. As a result, Pelosi threatened to yank away his very valuable spot on the Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, it's interesting to note that she ultimately didn't go ahead with the threat in the same way that, for example, Democratic leaders didn't go ahead and punish Alan Boyd, a centrist Democrat from Florida, for joining with a Republican to sponsor a Social Security privatization plan. Democrats don't seem to be as effective in following through on their threats as Republicans. However, they have made an effort to send a message to the rank and file members: if you cross us, you're at least going to have to worry about losing your plum committee spots. And that does have an effect on the mentality of members of Congress when they're deciding how to vote.
My guest is Juliette Eilprin, a national correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Fight Club Politics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Washington Post reporter Juliet Alperin. Her new book is called Fight Club Politics: How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives. You know, we were talking before about how Newt Gingrich changed the atmosphere in Congress in 1994 when he became a Speaker of the House, and the House had a Republican majority for the first time in 40 years. And one of the changes you say that he made is how he handled orientation for new congressmen. Now, this doesn't seem like it would necessarily be a big deal, but what was the significance of what he did? What were the changes he made, and what were their significance?
What Gingrich did is he decided that rather having a joint Democratic and Republican orientation, which is what had been the tradition, these members, upon winning their seats in Congress, would go to Harvard University's Kennedy School in order to learn about what it meant to be a member. He said, we're actually going to do it separately, and we're going to have Republicans only learn about Congress from the conservative perspective. He brought them to learn at the Heritage Institute, a conservative think tank. And while it doesn't seem like a big deal, it makes an impact. Those early days are, first of all, the time when you get to know other members of Congress. And so here immediately you're segregating Republicans and Democrats into separate camps. In this kind of climate, as Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio, put it to me, Gingrich was saying, we're going to do it on our own, which really has been the strategy of Republicans since they've taken power. And it really begins in those early days of orientation.
And Gingrich also discouraged congressmen from moving their families to Washington. Why?
He argued that by moving your family to Washington, you ran the risk of getting what people call Beltway fever. Essentially, what would happen is when you moved your family to Washington, you would become the very kind of Washington insider that Republicans had been attacking for years. And while on some level, there doesn't seem to be that much wrong with this, because you say, well, these members of Congress need to spend time with their constituents. If they keep their families in their home districts, they'll just even have more of an incentive to travel home and talk to the people they're representing. It really has had a corrosive effect on the ability of members of Congress to get to know each other. The statistics are pretty stark. In the, say, 20 years ago, you had something like two-thirds of members of Congress lived inside Washington, in the Washington, D.C. area. Now, four-fifths of members of Congress have decided to keep their principal residence and their families back in the home district. And it really has affected the level of civility on Capitol Hill. Members no longer spend time together, and as a result, it's become much easier for them to demonize members of the opposing party. And it used to be harder to do that, because maybe you'd want to yell at them, but if you knew you were seeing them for dinner later in the week, it would be harder to get away with attacking them. And now that they simply are strangers to each other, it's become much easier for them to attack each other.
Looking at the recent history of Congress, how do you think the impeachment of President Clinton affected divisions within the House?
It very much heightened divisions between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats saw this as a groundless attack on their party as well as their president, and it sowed the seeds of distrust that have existed to this day. And even with Republicans, interestingly, some of them came under fire for not being partisan enough. For example, Mark Souder, a conservative Republican from Indiana, voted for impeaching President Clinton, but he didn't vote for every count. And as a result, he has had a primary opponent in his district every election since then. His entire fundraising committee quit on him after the impeachment vote because they argued they couldn't raise money from loyal Republicans. And so that, again, sent a signal to Republicans, which is, if you decide to break with the party, you are going to pay the price ultimately in elections. And so I argue that that's had a huge effect in terms of destroying the kind of comity that is often essential to forging bipartisan legislative compromises on Capitol Hill.
We were talking before about ways you think that Democrats, the minority party in Congress, have been in the House, have been shut out of legislation. And you say now, rather than seeking a bipartisan majority for initiatives, that Republican leaders in the House are more interested in securing 218 votes from Republicans. Why does the Republican leadership prefer to have a Republican majority vote rather than a bipartisan vote?
This is a strategy they've had since the beginning of their control over Congress, although Denny Hastert, the current speaker from Illinois, articulated it in his speech, which is called, when he talked about the majority of the majority. Essentially, his belief, and this extends to the entire Republican leadership, is that bills that come to the House floor that are going to pass should have the majority of Republicans on board. And then if you get any Democrats, that's icing on the cake, but not essential for legislation. And really, their argument is, we keep winning these elections, therefore we're allowed to pursue our agenda, and Democrats are really incidental to that. And while on one level you understand what they're saying, again, it means that you're having bills that tend to be more conservative than the American public, because Republicans within the House are more conservative than even the average Republican across the country. And as a result, the legislation that you pursue from such a strategy is going to be more conservative than the American public as a whole. And again, they've done this time and time again. And ultimately, while they continue to produce a string of narrow victories, it again alienates people on the other side who feel like ultimately they're irrelevant to the legislative process.
Juliette Alperin is a national correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Fight Club Politics. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Juliette Alperin, author of the new book Fight Club Politics, How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives. The book traces how the already partisan House became even more divided after the Republicans took it over in 1994, and how Speaker Newt Gingrich established a new model for the governing body. Alperin is a national correspondent for The Washington Post and a former congressional correspondent for the paper. Now, another change in the recent past in Congress is that you say that Republicans have reduced the amount of time that legislators have to actually review new bills. Is that part of a strategy, and what does it accomplish?
It gives more power to the majority, because they know the final product that they're putting up for a House vote. But frankly, Democrats don't. And they will come up with bills that are hundreds and hundreds of pages long, where, first of all, very few members really know what's in the bill. But, you know, Republicans and Democrats will go to the floor, and they're often aides that are giving a thumbs up or thumbs down sign on the House floor that, you know, give people a sense of how they're supposed to vote. And what it does is empowers the leadership, disempowers rank and file members, and even some Democrats have said, you know, we should really take it to the point that we should go out to the steps of the Capitol with these bills that are hot off the presses and read them in front of the TV cameras, in front of the print reporters, and make a point that we're really not part of the process. And again, many Democrats haven't wanted to take it to that extent, but you really get the sense that members of Congress are voting on things that only a few people really know the contents of. And we've seen some kind of embarrassing incidents where they've noticed that staffers have put in provisions that no one else knew about, or their special interest provisions. Reporters are often in the position of figuring out the contents of bills after they've gone through the legislative process. And by doing that, that clearly doesn't give the public a sense of having an input into the legislative process.
Can you think of an example of something that's gotten into a bill because nobody had time to read it?
There was something that happened recently. It was a couple years ago on a major, what we call an omnibus bill. It was kind of the final spending bill that Congress was passing. And there was a Republican staffer that had put in a provision that was giving essentially the IRS more input into looking into people's private lives. And that was really something that was stunning. It was actually fixed later, but it really gave the IRS more access to Americans' documents than anyone had wanted. And ultimately, the boss of the person in question said, look, I didn't even approve this. This was done by a renegade staffer, and this does not reflect Republican values.
You know, earlier you were talking about how you think not only has Congress become more polarized, but the parties, particularly the Republicans, have become more extreme. And you talked a little bit about how loyalty tests and the whole reward and punishment system from the party leadership is kind of squeezing out moderates. You say that redistricting has also squeezed out moderates. In what way?
Redistricting has a huge impact on how members of Congress vote. Essentially, what you've had happen in recent decades is with, frankly, advances in technology, map makers have become much more sophisticated in terms of figuring out where Democrats and Republicans live and shaping districts so that they can have overwhelmingly safe Democratic districts or overwhelmingly safe Republican districts. And what this does is, again, gives an edge to people on the extreme edge of the ideological spectrum. If you have an overwhelmingly Democratic district, as a member of Congress running for office, all you care about is pleasing the most liberal members of your constituency, and vice versa for Republicans. And we've seen this happen time and time again, where they create districts where members of Congress worry much more about competition in their primary election than on the general election. And as a result, the men and women who are coming to Washington tend to be much more extreme because they're really worried about a thin segment of the population, but it's the segment of the population that's overrepresented in their congressional districts.
One thing that I really don't comprehend is, why is it that it's people from the parties who actually draw up the maps in redistricting?
That's an excellent question.
I mean, you would think that it would be impartial observers who would be, you know, looking at population change and redrawing the map, but it's not that way.
There's a blatant conflict of interest there, and it's amazing that it doesn't get challenged more often. But, you know, that's the way it is in many states. There are exceptions to it. For example, one of the ideas I talk about is expanding on the New Jersey model, which is a bipartisan commission. So you have Republicans and Democrats involved in the process, but then you have an independent tiebreaker. In the case of New Jersey, they tend to go with an academic who tries to rein in the more extreme elements, and essentially both parties have to try to please this independent tiebreaker in order to come with a fair result. Again, there are a few states that do have either independent commissions or bipartisan commissions, but for the bulk of states in the United States, the way it works is that you have legislatures or partisans who are doing it. And again, for example, there's someone named David Winston. He's a consultant here in town, and he's helped draw House districts for years. And he said, when I, as a map maker, have more influence over an election than a candidate or a campaign, the system is out of whack.
My guest is Juliette Eilprin, a national correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Fight Club Politics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Juliette Eilprin, a national correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book, Fight Club Politics, is about how the House of Representatives has become more partisan in the past decade. How did Tom DeLay change the Texas legislature from a long-term Democratic majority to a Republican one?
Well, he had a long-term strategy, which he devised along with some of his aides. And that strategy was to gain control of the state legislature first so that he could do something that was unprecedented, redrawing the congressional map in an off year when you were supposed to be done with redistricting. So what he and his aides did is they raised an extraordinary amount of money, which ultimately has led to several indictments in Texas for violating campaign finance law. And by doing that, they helped their party take control of the state house for the first time in an incredibly long time. And that allowed them, along with controlling the governorship, which they already had, to, in 2003, say, you know what, we're going to revisit the map that we had already had. And so what they did is they went down there and came up with a totally different map, which gave Republicans even more of an advantage than they have, for example, statewide and in polls of, you know, where Republicans and Democrats are in that state. And again, he was a real strategic thinker. He really thought, I need to win on the state level, and that way I'm going to have greater control in Congress. And I asked him about this in 2003. He was flying back and forth between Washington and Texas in order to influence the process. And I said, why are you doing this? Why are you spending such an extraordinary amount of time and effort in this remap? And he looked at me and said, Juliette, I'm the majority leader and I want more seats. And that's what he got. He ultimately got several seats out of that election.
Are you saying that a lot of congressional elections are really kind of done deals because of the way the areas have been remapped?
Absolutely. I was considering, in fact, naming my book Rigged initially, but that made my editors nervous, and so we didn't do it. But I would say that many elections in America today are rigged, and there's not a fair fight because so many of these districts are predetermined by the overwhelming number of Democrats or Republicans they have in their seats. Again, if you look at something like California, Richard Pombo is a very interesting figure. He's a conservative Republican who chairs the House Resources Committee. He represents the East Bay area and going out from there. And there are a lot of his constituents who have some concerns about his record, but his district was made safer after the 2000 census. And when we talked about it, I was recently out in his district. I did a piece about his campaign, and I said, you know, how worried are you about this? And he said, you know, Juliet, I have a 7% advantage now in this district. I didn't have that advantage when I initially won my seat. And so I'm not really worried. I'll have a tougher race than I've had in the past. But, you know, basically he said, I'll see you back in Washington after the November elections. And so I think that that speaks volumes to where we are today. There are 435 seats in Congress. But if you look at the number of races across the country, by the most generous definition, maybe you would have something like 42 seats in play this year. And that's pretty stunning when you think that in 90% of the House seats, I can tell you right now who's going to be returning to Washington after November.
What are the odds that that will change in the near future? How long are we kind of stuck with these kind of predetermined elections?
We're really at a critical moment right now in our political system. There are a couple things that could shake up the status quo. One is that the Supreme Court is going to be ruling any week now on the Texas redistricting case, where Democrats have argued the Republicans went too far and have taken gerrymandering to a new level. We could see some signal from the Supreme Court that things need to change and you need a different process. Now, again, that's pretty unlikely. I went in March, they had the oral arguments for that case, and I got the sense that the Supreme Court justices were very reluctant to interfere with what they see as the congressional domain as laid out by the Constitution. But it could happen. The other thing would be the fall elections. I think everyone's looking right now to get a signal from the American public about how they feel about the current political system, how they feel about President Bush. And if you saw significant Democratic gains in Congress, that would clearly send a message to the majority, the Republican Party, that things need to be done differently, as well as, of course, serve as a signal to Democrats that they may be in danger if they try to play by these same rules. And so I think what we're really waiting for is to get a message from voters about what they think about the current system and whether it's serving them. Again, the real problem with this is if you have so many districts that are rigged by gerrymandering, the problem becomes voters may not be able to really send the signal they want because so many of these members of Congress are destined for re-election.
Who do you think will be in the majority in Congress when November is over?
Oh, that's a really tough question. For a long time, I had said that the Republicans were still going to control the House, that was really pretty much a done deal because of the redistricting that we've talked about. I'm now hedging my bets more than I used to, given the sinking popularity of the president along with Congress itself. When you look at some of these numbers, of course, they're very similar to what we saw in 1994. So I think you have to say that at this point, it's a toss-up. But I'm still falling short of saying that Democrats will absolutely win the House back. That, I think, is still a tall order when you consider they need to win 15 seats. And while that might not sound like a lot, given that, again, there are roughly 40 seats in play under the most generous definition, that becomes an extraordinary mission when they also have to defend several Democratic seats, which I think will remain in Democratic hands, but still require resources, time, and effort.
It looks like Newt Gingrich is considering a run for his party's nomination for president. Now, a lot of your book is really about how Newt Gingrich led Congress to become more partisan when he was the House Speaker. Do you think he's changed at all?
I think he has changed somewhat. I actually just saw him yesterday, and we talked at length for this book, and I joked by the end of it when he was talking about how he agrees with me that redistricting has gotten out of control. You know, this is something that, of course, he endorsed back in the early 90s because he saw it as instrumental in helping his party
gain control of Congress. And I said to him during one interview, I don't know what's happened. Either maybe you've moved to the left or I've moved to the right. But the fact that we seem to be in agreement on some of these issues shows something is going on. I think that he certainly has become increasingly publicly critical of how Republicans are ruling the House. He's calling for more openness. He's saying that Democrats have been shut out to too great an extent. So it's a little hard to say what's behind this, but certainly in his statements, he is sounding more moderate than he had been when he first brought his party back into power.
Well, Juliette Eilprin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Juliette Eilprin is the author of Fight Club Politics. She's a national correspondent for The Washington Post.